Mary's heart restarted itself, sending her own blood, and all at once the flashlight's yellow began to look red and wavery. She heard a high, sweet singing in her ears. "Don't you faint! Don't you dare!" The flashlight beam swung to the left. In the corner was a roiling nest of rattlesnakes. She turned around with the light, and when it happened upon the other three bodies that were in here with her, she understood several things at once. The fact that she had discovered the source of the bad smell was only the least of them. The bodies at the foot of the wall were in an advanced state of decay, delirious with maggots. But they hadn't been simply dumped. They were lined up, perhaps even laid out. The man in the middle really was black, she thought, although it was impossible to tell for sure. She didn't know him or the one on his right, but the one on the black guy's left she did know, in spite of the toiling maggots and the decomposition. As she watched, a spider ran out of Collie in Trajan's mouth. The beam of the light shook as she ran it along the line of corpses again. Three big men, not a one of the three under 6'5". "I know why I'm here instead of in jail," she thought. "I'm next. When it's through with Ellen, I'm next." Mary began to scream. The Antok chamber glowed with a faint red light that seemed to come from the air itself. Something which still looked a bit like Ellen Carver walked across it, accompanied by a retinue of scorpions and fiddlebacks. Above it, around it, the stone faces of the Cantoks peered down. In front of it was the pit, the Ini, well of the worlds. The light could have been coming from here, but it was impossible to tell for sure. Sitting in a circle around the mouth of the Ini were coyotes and buzzards. Ellen's body walked slowly. Ellen's head sagged. Blood ran down her legs in thin, steady streams. Ellen had been suffering from a yeast infection. Just a yeast infection, nothing at all in the ordinary scheme of things. But it had been enough to start the dominoes falling. And now, well, there was Mary. It didn't quite dare take her yet. Not until it knew what the others were going to do. If the wretched little prey boy prevailed and they came south, Mary might serve as bait or as a hostage. She would serve as neither, however, if the prey boy sensed she was no longer human. It sat down on the edge of the Ini and stared into it. Things were on the verge of going badly wrong. Looking back, it saw clearly that some other force had perhaps been working against it from the start. It was afraid of the boy, especially in its current weakness. Most of all, it was terrified of being completely shut up beyond the narrow throat of the Ini again, like a genie in a bottle. But that didn't have to be. The boy could die. "Tak," it whispered into the darkness. "Tak in to Ini. Tak Allah. Tak Awan." From below, deep in the humming red silence of the Ini, came the wet tongue sound of something slithering. "The man who showed me these things, the man who guided me, told me to tell you that none of this is destiny." David's arms were clasped around his knees and his head was bent. He seemed to be speaking to his sneakers. "In a way, that's the scariest part. Pye's dead, and Mr. Billingsley, and everyone else in desperation. Because one man hated the Mining Safety and Health Administration, and another was too curious and hated being tied to his desk. That's all." "And God told you all this?" Johnny asked. The boy nodded, still without looking up. "I got inside his head." He paused. "Ripton, that was his name. He was the first." And still looking down between his cocked knees at his sneakers, David began to talk. "The man who hates MSHA is Carrie Ripton, pit foreman of the new rattlesnake operation. He's 48, balding, cynical, in pain more often than not these days, a man who desperately wanted to be a mining engineer but wasn't up to the math, and wound up here instead, running an open pit. when Kirk Turner runs into the field office this afternoon, face blazing with excitement, to tell him that the last blast pattern has uncovered an old drift mine and that there are bones inside, Ripton's first impulse is to tell him to organize a party of volunteers. They're going in. He's too old a hand for childish fantasies about lost gold mines and troves of Indian artifacts, but as he and Turner rush out, part of him is thinking about those things just the same. Oh, yes. Ripton and Turner walk up to the edge of the hole. There is a dank, strange smell coming out of it, and yes, there are bones. He can see them scattering back into the canted, downsloping darkness of an old-fashioned square drift mine. What is this? Turner asks him. Any idea? Of course he does. It's Rattlesnake Number One, the old China shaft. He opens his mouth to say so, then closes it again. This is not a matter for a blast monkey like Kirk Turner, and is certainly not one for his crew, nitro boys who spend their weekends in Eli gambling, whoring, drinking, and talking, of course, talking about anything and everything, and the foreman who leads an expedition into the Longberry China shaft today might find himself in federal court, facing a $50,000 fine and a possible 5 years in jail the week after next. There are at least 9 red-letter regulations expressly forbidding entry into unsafe and unimproved structures, which this, of course, is. He instructs Turner to have yellow restricted area tapes placed across the opening. He then turns to the rest of the crew and reminds them that the newly uncovered drift, which might turn out to be a historical and archaeological treasure trove, is on DMC property. I don't expect you to keep this quiet forever, he tells them, but as a favor to me, I'd like you to keep your mouth shut for the next few days. Let me notify the brass. That part should be easy, at least. Symes, the comptroller, is coming in from Phoenix next week. Turner wants to take some pictures of the exposed drift after he clocks out. Ripton lets him. It seems the quickest way to get rid of him. How far in do you think we punched it? Turner asks, standing about 2 feet beyond the yellow tape and snapping pictures with his Nikon. Pictures that, with no flash, will show nothing but a black hole and a few scattered bones that might belong to a deer. No way to tell, Ripton says. In his mind, he's inventorying the equipment he'll take in with him. You ain't gonna do nothing dumb after I'm gone, are you? Turner asks. Nope, Ripton says. I have too much damn respect for mining safety to even think of such a thing. Yeah, right, Turner says, laughing. And early the next morning, around 2 o'clock, a much larger version of Carrie Ripton will enter the bedroom Turner shares with his wife and shoot the man as he sleeps. His wife, too. Tuck. It's a busy night for Carrie Ripton. A night of killing and a night of placing cantas. He spends most of the night placing these relics, leaving them in odd corners, mailboxes, glove compartments. It's 4:45. He has over 2 hours before the first members of Pascal Martinez's small Saturday day crew show up. It should be enough, but there is certainly no time to waste. Carrie Ripton's body is bleeding so badly he's had to stuff his underwear full of toilet paper to absorb it. And twice on his way out to the mine, he has had to stop and yark a gutful of blood out the window of Carrie's pickup truck. He drives on to the field office, unlocks the door with Ripton's key, and kills Joe Prudham, the night watchman. Old Joe isn't much of a night watchman. He's sitting down to have his topsy-turvy version of dinner, and everything's cozy right up to the moment when Ripton puts a bullet in his throat. That done, Ripton calls the Owls Club in town. It's where Brad Josephson, he of the gorgeous chocolate skin and long sloping gut, eats breakfast 6 days a week, and always at this brutally early hour. Ripton wants Brad on hand, and quickly, before the black man can be polluted by the cantas. The cantas are useful in many ways, but they spoil a man or woman for Tok's greater work. Ripton knows he can take someone from Martina's crew if he needs to, perhaps even Pascal himself, but he wants, well, Tok wants, actually, Brad. Brad will be useful in other ways. "Owls," says a woman's voice in his ear. The sun's not even up, and she sounds tired already. "Howdy, Denise," he says. "How they hanging?" "Who's this?" deeply suspicious. "Carrie Ripton, hon. You don't recognize my voice?" "You must have a bad case of morning mouth, darling. Are you coming down with a cold?" "Cold, I guess," he says, grinning and wiping blood off his lower lip. "Listen, hon, is Brad in?" "Right over in the corner where he always is, living large and eating nasty. 4 eggs, home fries, about a 1/2 pound of limp-fried bacon. What you want Brad for at this hour of a Saturday morning?" "Company business." "Huh," she says, and the phone goes down with a clunk. "Brad," he hears her yell, "phone, for you, Mr. Wonderful." A moment later, Brad Josephson is on the line. He says hello like a man who knows perfectly well that Publishers Clearinghouse doesn't call at 5 a.m. to tell you you won the big one. "Brad, it's Carrie Ripton," he says. "We punched into the old one. Less than 20 feet in, you'll get the most amazing photographs. I'm on my way. Don't you move. Don't you goddamn move." The phone clicks in his ear, and Ripton grins with red lips. "I won't," he said. "Candelach. Attend. Talk." 5 minutes later, Josephson comes down the steep grade of the pit road, sitting bolt upright behind the wheel of an old Buick. Ripton watches him from the door of the field office. It wouldn't do for Brad to get a good look at him, either. Not until he gets a little closer. No problem there. Brad parks with a scrunch of tires, gets out, grabs 3 different cameras, and trots toward the field office, pausing only to gape at the open hole 20 feet or so up the slope. "Holy shit, it's the China, all right," he says. "Gotta be. Come on, Carrie, for Christ's sake. Martinez'll be here any time." "Nah, they start a little later on Saturday," he says, grinning. "Come in here. Got something to show you." "Something you brought out?" "That's right," Ripton says. Josephson is still frowning down at his swinging cameras, trying to sort out the straps, when Ripton grabs him and throws him to the back of the room. Josephson squawks indignantly. "Cool your jets," Ripton says as he steps outside and locks the door. "Gosh, relax." Laughing, he goes to the truck and gets in. Like many Westerners, Carrie Ripton believes passionately in the right of Americans to bear arms. There's a shotgun in the rack behind the seat and a nasty little hideout gun, a Ruger Speed 6, in the glove box. He loads the shotgun and lays it across his lap. Pretty soon, Pascal Martinez shows up for some of that good old Saturday morning time and a half. He's got Miguel Rivera, his amigo, with him. He parks on the other side of the field office, and then he and Mig walk around to see what Ripton's doing here on Saturday morning and at this ungodly hour. Ripton sticks the shotgun out the window, still smiling, and shoots both of them. They die with puzzled looks on their faces. The rest of the crew arrives by ones and twos. No one worries much about the time clock on Saturdays. Ripton shoots them as they come, dragging their bodies around to the back of the field office, where they soon begin to stack up beneath the clothes dryer's exhaust pipe like cordwood. By 7:45, Ripton has killed everyone on Pascal Martinez's A crew. As a bonus, he gets the one-legged guy from Bud Suds, who has come out to service the coffee machine. 25 bodies behind the field office. It is time to make the jump. He wants out of this unpleasantly decaying body, and if he doesn't make the switch soon, he never will. When he opens the door, Brad Josephson rushes him. He expects to be shot, but of course Carrie can't do that. Instead, he grabs Josephson's arms, calling on the last of this body's strength to do it, and shoves the black man against the wall so hard that the entire prefab building shakes. "What are you doing?" Josephson asks, trying to squirm away as Ripton's face bears down on his and rips open. "Kiss me, beautiful," Ripton exclaims, and slams his mouth down on Josephson's. He makes a blood seal through which he exhales. Josephson goes rigid in Ripton's arms and begins to tremble. Ripton exhales and exhales, going out and out and out, feeling it happen, feeling the transfer. For one terrible moment, the essence of Tok is naked, caught between Ripton, who is collapsing, and Josephson, who has begun to swell like a float on the morning of the Thanksgiving Day parade. And then, instead of looking out of Ripton's eyes, it is looking out of Josephson's eyes. It feels a wonderful, intoxicating sense of rebirth. It is filled with the grease-fired energy of a man who eats 4 eggs and 1/2 pound of limp bacon for breakfast. It feels... "I feel great!" Brad Josephson exclaims in a boisterous Tony the Tiger voice. It drops Ripton's body. The body feels as light as a burst seed pod, and strides toward the door, listening to the seams of Josephson's khaki shirt tear open as his shoulders widen and his arms lengthen. His feet don't grow as much, but enough to burst the laces of his tennis shoes. Tok stands outside, grinning hugely. It gets into the Buick, splitting the seam running up the back of Brad Josephson's pants all the way to the belt loops. Then, grinning at the thought of the bumper sticker on the front of the car, "Miners go deeper and stay longer," it swings around the field office and heads back toward Desperation, stretching out a rooster tail of dust behind the fast-moving car. David stopped. His voice had grown husky with talking. The others stood around him in a semicircle, pretty much as Johnny supposed the wise old Wallace had once stood around the boy Jesus while he gave him the scoop, the lowdown, the latest buzz, the true gin. Johnny squatted to get a fresh bottle of Jolt, not feeling his wallet, genuine alligator Barney's $350, which had worked most of the way out of his back pocket, slip out and drop to the floor. He tapped David's hand with the neck of the bottle. The boy looked up, smiling, and Johnny was shocked at how tired he looked. He thought about David's explanation of Tok, trapped in the earth like an ogre in a fairy tale, using human beings like paper cups because it wore their bodies out so rapidly, and wondered if David's god was much different. "Anyway, that's how he does it," David said in his husky voice. "The kiss of death instead of the kiss of life," Ralph said. David nodded. "But what kissed Ripton?" Cynthia asked. "When he went into the mine the night before, what kissed him?" "I don't know," David said. "Either I wasn't shown or I don't understand. All I know is that it happened at the well. It had to get Ripton into the mine because it can't get through the Eni, the well. All it can do is catch people, inhabit them, make them into Kantok, and trade them in when they wear out." Johnny walked toward the back of the Ryder truck, then wheeled around. "What does Tok want? To get out of its hole in the ground and stretch his legs? Eat pork rinds, snort cocaine, and drink tequila sunrises? Screw some NFL cheerleaders? Ask Bob Dylan what the lyrics to Gates of Eden really mean? Rule the earth? What?"
"It doesn't matter," David said quietly.
"Huh?"
"All that matters is what God wants, and what he wants is for us to go up to the China pit. All the rest is just story hour."
Johnny smiled. It felt tight and a little painful, too small for his mouth. "Tell you what, sport, what your God wants doesn't matter in the least to me." He turned back to the Ryder truck's rear door and ran it up. He jumped down from the back of the truck, wincing at the twinge of pain in his back. His nose was hurting again, too, big time. "Frankly, David, I trust God about as far as I can sling a piano." He looked back in at the boy, smiling. "You trust him all you want. I guess it's a luxury you can still afford. Your sister's dead, your mother's turned into Christ knows what, but there's still your father to work through before Tok goes to work on you personally." David jerked. His mouth trembled. His face crumpled and he began to cry.
"You bitch!" Cynthia shouted at Johnny. "You cunt!"
She rushed to the back of the truck and kicked at him. Johnny dodged back, the toe of her small foot missing his chin by only an inch or two. "Lady, I never pretended to be a saint," Johnny said, and it came out the way he wanted, easy and ironic and amused. But inside, he was horrified.
"What happened to you?" Steve asked. "You walked up to that cougar big as life and blew her head off."
"You don't understand. That was hot blood. You know what my trouble is? If you give me a chance to think, I'll take it." He took another step backward. No god stopped him. "Good luck, you guys. David, for whatever it's worth, you're an extraordinary young man."
"If you go, it's over," David said.
His face was still against his father's chest. His words were muffled but audible.
"The chain breaks. Tok wins."
"Yeah, but when playoff time comes, he's ours," Johnny said, and laughed again. It was the way he had been laughing when he climbed out of the pool at the Bel Air, still holding his beer in one hand. But so what? He could laugh any fucking way he wanted to. He had once won the National Book Award, after all. "I'm going to take a car from the mining office lot. I'm going to drive like hell until I get to Austin, and then I'm going to make an anonymous call to the state police, tell them some bad shit's happened in desperation. Then I'll take some rooms in the local Best Western and hope you guys show up to use them. If you do, drinks are on me. One way or another, I'm stepping off the wagon tonight. I think desperation's cured me of sobriety forever." David joined Steve and Cynthia at the back of the truck. He still looked pale and worn, but he was calm.
"Its mark is on you," he said. "It will let you go, but you'll wish you'd stayed when you start smelling it on your skin."
Johnny looked at the boy for a long time, fighting an urge to walk back to the truck, fighting it with all the considerable force of will at his disposal.
"So I'll wear lots of aftershave," he said. "Bye, boys and girls. Live right."
He walked away, and as fast as he could, any faster, and he would have been running. There was silence in the truck. They watched until Johnny was out of sight, and still no one said anything. David stood with his father's arm around him, and he had never felt so hollow, so empty, so utterly done in. He kicked one of the empty Jolt bottles, his eye following its skitter to the wall of the truck, where it bounced and came to rest next to... David stepped forward.
Look, Johnny's wallet. It must have fallen out of his...
He bent forward and picked up Johnny's wallet. When he touched it, something that felt like a wallop of electricity exploded in his head. He fell against the wall of the truck, clutching the wallet.
David?
Ralph asked. His voice was distant, his concern echoing over 1,000 miles. Ignoring him, David opened the wallet. He thumbed a snap on the wallet's left interior side, releasing an accordion of sleeved photographs. He was faintly aware of the others moving in around him as he looked through the pictures, using one finger to spool back through the years. Each Johnny was a little younger, the head hair and facial hair darker, the lines in the face less carven until...
Here, David whispered. Oh, God, here.
He tried to take the photo out of its transparent pocket and couldn't. His hands were shaking too badly. Steve took the wallet, removed the picture, and handed it to the boy. Dave's eyes with the awe of an astronomer discovered a brand new planet.
I knew something was there, David said, almost too faintly for the others to hear. As soon as I saw his wallet on the floor. But it was him. He paused, then repeated it wonderingly. It was him.
Who was who? Ralph asked.
David didn't answer, only stared at the picture. It showed three men standing in front of a ramshackle cinderblock building, a bar judging from the Budweiser sign in the window. The sidewalks were crowded with Orientals. The men on the left and right of the trio were wearing polo shirts and slacks. The man in the middle was wearing jeans and a gray t-shirt. A Yankees baseball cap was pushed far back on his head. Over his head, over the door of the bar from which they had apparently just emerged, was a hand-painted sign. The name of the place was the Viet Cong Lookout. She didn't actually faint, but Mary screamed until something in her head gave way and the strength deserted her muscles. She staggered forward, grabbing the table with one hand, not wanting to. There were black widows and scorpions crawling all over it, not to mention a corpse with a nice, tasty bowl of blood in front of him, but she wanted to go tumbling face first onto the floor even less. The floor was the domain of the snakes. She settled for dropping to her knees, holding onto the edge of the table with the hand that wasn't holding the flashlight. There was something strangely comforting about this posture. After a moment's thought, she knew what it was. David, of course. And without thinking about it, she slipped into prayer herself for the first time since she had been 11 years old.
God, she said, I need help. I'm in a room filled with creepy crawlies, mostly poisonous, and I'm scared to death. If you're there, anything you can do would be appreciated.
Amen, it was supposed to be, but she broke off before she could finish saying it, her eyes wide. A clear voice spoke in her head, and not her own voice either, she was sure of it. It was as if someone had just been waiting, and not very patiently, for her to speak first.
There's nothing here that can hurt you, it said.
Not yet. She didn't know who that voice belonged to, but if that was the way God answered prayers, she supposed it was no wonder the world was in such deep shit, because there was plenty here that could hurt her. Plenty.
No,
the voice said patiently, even as she turned the flashlight past the decomposing bodies lined up on the floor and discovered another writhing tangle of snakes. No, they can't, and you know why. The virus which had haunted these bodies was now in Ellen, and if she, Mary Jackson, was supposed to be its next home, then the things in here really couldn't hurt her.
You have to get out of here,
the voice told her, before it comes back.
Mary stabbed the black with the flashlight until she found the door. She crossed to it on legs that felt numb and distant, trying not to tread on the spiders that were scurrying everywhere. The doorknob turned, but the door would only go back and forth an inch or so. When she yanked it hard, she could hear what sounded like a padlock rattling outside. She shone the light around again, running it over the rusty sink, the counter with the coffee maker and the little microwave, the washer-dryer set. Then the pot-bellied stove, a tool chest, a few picks and shovels in a rusty tangle, a calendar showing a blonde in a bikini. No windows, not a single one.
"Try the dryer, Mare."
That was she herself. Had to be. But she was damned if it sounded like her, and it didn't feel exactly like a thought, either. She hurried over to the dryer, taking less care about where she put her feet this time and stepping on several of the spiders. The smell of decay seemed stronger over here, which was strange, since the bodies were on the other side of the room, but a diamondback rattler poked up the dryer's lid and began slithering out. It hissed at her.
"Fuck you, bro," Mary said.
She seized it, pulled it out of the dryer, it was easily 4 feet long, and flung it across the room. Then she banged down the lid with the base of the flashlight, not wanting to see what else might be inside, and pulled the dryer away from the wall. There was a pop as the pleated plastic exhaust hose pulled out of the hole in the wall. Mary bent down to look at the hole. It was about 2 feet across, too small to crawl through, but the edges were badly corroded, and she thought... She went back across the room, kicking impatiently at a rat which had been hiding behind the bodies, and most likely gorging on them. She seized one of the picks, went back to the exhaust hole, and pushed the dryer a little further aside to give herself room. The smell of putrefaction was stronger now, but she hardly noticed. She worked the short end of the pick through the hole, pulled upward, and gave a little crow of delight when the tool yanked a furrow nearly 18 inches long through the rotted, rusted metal.
"Hurry, Mary, hurry!"
She leaned forward and folded back the two sides of the slit she'd made like wings, then got on her knees and peered out through the hole. The stench was now so strong it made her feel like gagging.
"God!" she screamed in a high, strengthless voice. "Oh, Jesus, no!"
Her first shocked impression was that there were hundreds of bodies stacked behind the building she was in. The whole world seemed to be white, slack faces, glazed eyes and torn flesh.
"Not that many," she told herself. "Not that many, Mary, old kid. And even if there were 1,000, it wouldn't change your situation."
"I'll land on them," she whispered. The light in her hand was jittering uncontrollably, picking out cheeks and brows and tufted ears.
"You have to go, Mary," the voice told her patiently. "You have to go now, or it will be too late."
All right, but she didn't have to see her landing zone. No way. She turned off the flashlight and tossed it out through the hole. She heard a soft thunk as it landed on, well, on something. She took a deep breath, closed her eyes, and slipped out. She tilted forward, and then she was falling, still with her eyes squeezed shut. She put her hands out in front of her. One landed on someone's face. She felt the cold, unbreathing prow of the nose in her palm and the eyebrows under her fingers. The other hand squashed into some cold jelly and skidded. She landed on things that shifted and belched dead breath. Telling herself not to panic, to just hold on, Mary rolled away from them, already rubbing the hand which had skidded in the jelly stuff on her pants. Now there was sand beneath her, and the sharp points of small broken rocks. She opened her eyes and saw the flashlight lying by an outstretched, waxy hand.
"I'm out," she thought, taking the flashlight. "At least there's that. Dear God, thank you for that."
She backed away from the dead pile on her knees, the flashlight clamped between her arm and her breast, dragging her tingling hands through the broken ground, scouring them. There was a light to her left. She looked that way and felt a burst of terror as she saw in Trajan's cruiser.
"It's empty. The car's empty. You can see that, can't you?"
Ellen had brought her out here in the cruiser, then gone somewhere else. If only she'd left the keys. The cruiser reeked of blood and piss and pain and fear. Lying in the footwell on the passenger side was a small stone spider. It was an old thing and pitted, but just looking at it made Mary feel cold and weak. Not that she would have to worry about it much. The cruiser's ignition slot was empty.
Shit, Mary whispered fiercely. Shit on toast.
She bent into the car again, yanked the hood release, then walked around to the front of the car. She raised the Caprice's hood. The engine inside was huge, but she had no trouble spotting the air cleaner. She leaned over it, grasped the butterfly nut in the center, and applied pressure. Nothing happened. She hissed with frustration and blinked more sweat out of her eyes. A little over a year ago, she had read poems as part of a cultural event called Women Poets Celebrate Their Sense and Sexuality. Her long poem, My Vase, had been quite the hit of the evening. Of course, all that had been before her visit to the historic and beautiful China Pit, home of the unique and fascinating Rattlesnake No. 2 mine. She doubted if any of the people who had heard her read My Vase at that event would recognize her now. She no longer recognized herself.
Please, God, help me do this. Please help me be strong enough to...
This time, when she applied pressure, the butterfly nut turned.
Thanks, she panted. Oh, yeah, thanks very much, and take care of David and the others, will you? Don't let them leave this shithole without me.
She spun the butterfly nut off and let it fall into the engine. She pulled the air cleaner off its post, revealing a carburetor almost as big as... Well, almost as big as a vase. Laughing, Mary squatted, got a fistful of China Pit, pushed down a metal flap thingy over one of the carb's chambers, and stuffed the sand and rock in.
Let's see you drive that, you bitch, she panted.
Hurry, Mary. You have to hurry. She didn't know how she knew that, if it was the voice, or God, or just some intuition of her own, and she didn't care. Right now, she only cared about one thing, getting the bloody hell out of here. She snapped off the flash, the moon would give her all the light she needed, at least for a while, and began to trudge up the road which led out of China Pit. The literary lion stood by the computers set up at one end of the long table, looking across the lab toward the far wall, where over a dozen people had been hung on hooks, like experimental subjects in a Nazi death camp, all pretty much the way Steve and Cynthia had described it, except for one thing. The woman hanging just beneath the words, "You must wear a hard hat," the one whose head was cocked so far over to the right that her cheek lay on her shoulder, looked weirdly like Terry. He knew what he had to do, cross the room and start going through their pockets, pulling the car keys, but knowing wasn't the same as doing. To reach in, to feel the stiff dead skin of their legs under his hand, with only the thin pocket material between him and it. Stop, he whispered. Just go on and do it. Johnny started across the room. Yes, all right. So for the moment he felt like one of the ARVN looters he had seen in Quang Tri, looking for gold religious medallions on the corpses, sometimes even separating the buttocks of the dead in hopes of finding a diamond or pearl. But that was a specious comparison, and would turn out to be a transitory feeling, he was sure. Looting corpses wasn't what he was here for at all. Keys, a set that matched one of the cars in the parking lot, was what he was here for, and all he was here for. Furthermore, the dead girl under You Must Wear a Hard Hat really did look like Terry. He looked to the left, wanting to get his eyes off the dead blonde who looked so much like Terry, and what he saw made him grin hopefully. There was an ATV over there. Parked inside the garage door like it was, he thought there was a better than even chance that the keys would be in the ignition. All he'd have to do would be to unhook the ore carrier, run up the garage door, and ride away. And the key to the ATV was, praise God, in the ignition. He went to the back of the little jeep-like vehicle and examined the ore cart coupling. No problem there, either. Just a glorified cotter pin was all it was. Tell me something, Johnny, Terry said, and he froze in his tracks. When exactly was it that you decided to deal with your fear of dying by giving up real life completely? That voice wasn't in his head. He was all but sure of it. Hell, he was sure of it. It was Terry, hanging on the wall. If he turned around now, he would see her with her head raised, her cheek no longer on her shoulder, looking at him as she had always looked at him when he fucked up. Patient, because Johnny Marinville fucking up was the usual course of things. Disillusioned, because she was the only one who kept expecting him to do better. He stalked to the table on trembling legs, meaning to throw the hammer at the bitch to see if that would shut her up, except he couldn't. He couldn't, and that was when he heard the low growling from his left. He turned his head in that direction and saw a timber wolf, very likely the same one that had approached even Cynthia with the canteen in its mouth, standing in the doorway leading back to the offices. Its eyes glowed at him greenly. For a moment it hesitated, and Johnny allowed himself to hope. Maybe it was afraid, maybe it would back off. Then it was running at him full tilt, its muzzle wrinkling back to expose its teeth. The thing which had been Ellen had been concentrating on the wolf, using the wolf to finish with the rider so deeply that it was in a state akin to hypnosis. Now something interrupted Toc's concentration. It pulled back for a moment, holding the wolf where it was, but turning toward the rider truck with the rest of its terrible curiosity and dark regard. They were in there, all of them. They had to be, and Toc would have to leave it at that, because something else was wrong as well, something even closer to home. Something wrong with Mary. Feeling strangely and uncomfortably harried, it let the rider truck fade and centered on the field office, looking through the uneasily shifting eyes of the creatures which filled it. It registered the out-of-place dryer first, then the fact that Mary was gone. "You bitch!" it screamed, and blood flew out of Ellen's mouth in a fine spray. The thing that looked like Ellen slipped out through the rift in the wall of the Antoc and limped toward the faint purple square that marked the place where the old shaft now opened into the outside world. At the entrance to the China shaft, it paused, looking down. The moon had passed behind the prong of rock jutting up from the far side of the pit, but it still shed some light. Enough for Ellen's eyes to see that the cruiser's hood was up, and for the creature now inhabiting Ellen's brain to understand that the sly Ospa had fucked the motor up somehow. How had she dared? For the first time, Toc was afraid. Clenching and unclenching Ellen's fists nervously, aware that Ellen's thighs were painted with blood, Toc closed Ellen's eyes and looked for Mary. "Me him in tow, in tow, in tow!" At first there was nothing, just blackness and the slow flux of cramps deep down in Ellen's stomach. Then it saw what it was looking for, not with Ellen's eyes, but with the ears inside of Ellen's ears, a sudden alien echo of sound that made the shape of a woman. It was a circling bat that had seen Mary as she struggled up the road toward the rim of the pit. The bat saw the smells coming off her quite clearly, and what Toc picked up was encouraging. It was the smell of fear, mostly, the sort which might tilt into panic with one hard push. Still, Mary was only 400 yards or so from the top of the pit, and after that, the going would be downhill. There was also the fact that Mary was not bleeding like a stuck pig. This next to useless Ellen Carver body was. "I'm coming just the same, sweetheart," it whispered, moving away from the mine shaft and toward the road. Yes, coming just the same. It might have to beat this body to flinders in order to catch up with the Ospa, but it would catch up. Ellen turned her head, spat blood, grinned. She no longer looked much like the woman who had been considering a run for the school board, the woman who had enjoyed lunch with her friends at China Happiness, the woman whose deepest, darkest sexual fantasies involved making love to the hunk in the Diet Coke commercials. "It doesn't matter how fast you hurry, Ospa, you're not getting away."